Raised on 5 acres in rural South Central Virginia, my family only had one neighbor within walking distance. Mr. and Mrs. Vaughn lived up the road. The Vaughns were country folk. He worked for the railroad, and she was a housewife. They owned horses that I loved to visit, and they had a pond full of bluegill. Mrs. Vaughn would call on occasion to ask if we had a dozen eggs she could buy. We raised chickens. And off I would go, up the road, carrying the eggs. Mrs. Vaughn wasn't much of a gossip, something really out of the ordinary for my small town in Virginia. She didn't seem to relish dragging people through the mud. When details about someone or something would come up in conversation, her consistent response was this: "Well, we all have our pernumesis." For example, Miss Pearl was a woman who roamed around our town mumbling and cussing. If you got close enough, she would spit at you. She braided grass, she carried a broom, and would suddenly start sweeping the streets. People speculated that she was that way because some man had broken her heart after the war. Mrs. Vaughn would say, "Bless her heart, we all have our pernumesis." Now, for the record, I've looked for this word, pernumesis. I have imagined every possible spelling. I have looked for pernume as a possible root, with no luck, but it really matters little. What matters is the underlying message of Eleanor Vaughn's observation: we all have our pernumesis. Accepting those pernumi, if that's the plural, it was essential in our small town. Besides Miss Pearl, there were many more. There was Donnie. Donnie raised the prettiest roses in Campbell County, Virginia, and his mama made him wear dresses all his life. I have no idea what the real story was. There was Claude Patterson, who also lived up the road. Claude made moonshine in a car radiator and was mean as a snake when he was drunk. And my favorite, there was Ray. Ray loved church, and he would sit in the back. And on a silent Southern Baptist Sunday morning, after a particularly good hymn, Ray would cry out, "Hot damn amen!" Feel free to do that this morning. It makes me feel at home. This phrase has stayed with me for years, partly because I find it so humorous, and partly because it speaks a deeper truth for me. Each and every one of us has our own imperfections, our battle scars, our armor, our vulnerabilities. What we yearn for is a place that will take us in, not with the intention of erasing all those shortcomings. We yearn for the community that welcomes us as we are and extends the unspoken invitation to be more. More healed, more loving, more compassionate. If I could, I would ask Eleanor Vaughn questions about that phrase. She, of course, has been gone for many years. I would like to know if her interpretation matches my own. I imagine her explaining that she felt it somehow important to make room for all people, regardless of their shortcomings. That she felt called to not engage in gossip and mean-spiritedness. She exercised her power of refusal and found a small way to stand up for the quirky, the broken, or the voiceless. Now, let's be clear. I know this is folly on my part. The history of most Southern phrases hardly ever leads to any kind of ethical compass. Bless our hearts. When I found myself walking into my first Unitarian Universalist congregation, I was one of the brokenhearted. I was in need of nothing more to simply know that I was welcomed in that brokenness. Yes, a girl had broken my heart, and I was just pitiful. That congregation loved up on me, and here I am today. A group of people refused to let me go. I was welcomed in my heartbreak and encouraged to go beyond it. Since that time, I have taught, encouraged, modeled, learned about, and preached radical hospitality. But I think I've been missing an essential part, perhaps the most essential. I realize that welcoming people onto our own turf really is the easy part. After all, very few visitors come to us without having vetted themselves before they arrive at our doors. As long as our differences are acceptable, or as long as there is an unspoken agreement that the newcomer assimilate to our way of being, their pernumesis will likely fit in well with our own. We often work from the model of preparing ourselves in case these people come to us. Quite frankly, Unitarian Universalism deserves more. The time has come to step out of the comfort zone of radical hospitality. I believe the next essential step for our faith is to truly walk boldly into the world and employ radical hospitality across racial divides, socioeconomic divides, and with those who are radically different from us on their turf, not ours. Last month marked the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. Perhaps you saw footage on the news of survivors making, for some, the first pilgrimage back to that site that symbolizes a timeless commentary on humanity. Having visited during my time in Europe, I became and remain convinced that if ever there was a haunted place, Auschwitz is it. To witness those people traveling back is a living testament to the power of resilience in the face of our darkest human endeavors. These living witnesses to rampant evil know all too well that all of us, must refuse to let the power of hatred outweigh our own power of love, of compassion, of welcoming. Roman Kent, who was deported to Auschwitz from a German ghetto, was one of the survivors who spoke during the commemoration of the liberation. He pointed out that it is our moral obligation to instill in the current and future generations the understanding of what happens when what he called virulent prejudice and hatred are allowed to flourish. Kent, who now resides here in the United States, pointed to the visible proof of compassion and involvement he sees in the world today. However, he ended his comments with a challenge that speaks to each and every one of us. There remains, he stated, so much more to be done. We all must be involved and stay involved. No one should ever be just a spectator. I feel so strongly about this point, he said, that if I had the power, I would add an 11th commandment to the 10 commandments. You should never, never be a bystander. James Luther Adams, one of the great Unitarian theologians of the 20th century, was both unsettled and transformed by the ease with which many German Unitarians were lulled into being bystanders during the rise of the Nazi Party. Adams felt that each of us individually comes to a moment that we must decide. Do we continue acting as a bystander, or do we take a stand? We must, Adams wrote, love each other or perish. In 1927, Adams was visiting Germany, and he attended a Sunday parade. The parade was actually 4 hours of pro-Nazi pomp and power. He found himself suddenly in a heated argument with some pro-Nazi supporters. Out of the blue, he was seized from behind, forced down a side street and into an alley. His unknown captor spun him around and shouted at him, "You fool! Don't you know that if you are watching a parade in Germany today, you either keep your mouth shut or get your head bashed in?" Adams chose to keep his mouth shut, unsure whether he was safe. The man continued, "I am anti-Nazi. As I watched your situation, I thought back to my times in New York City as a merchant marine. So many times there, I received hospitality from strangers, and I said to myself, here is my chance to repay that hospitality. So I grabbed you, and here we are." The man invited Adams to join his family for a meal, and they shared time together in the family's slum apartment. Adams wrote that within the span of this meal, he learned vividly the distress that people lived with, and it had a long-lasting impact on how James Luther Adams saw our social responsibility, our personal responsibility to one another in the language of covenant, our power of refusal when facing inequity, and the cost of complicity. Adams would write, "I became acutely aware of the necessity for explicit commitment. In contrast to a vague sort of liberalism opposed to prejudices and promoting openness of mind." This is a powerful quote. I want to repeat it to you again. "I became acutely aware of the necessity for explicit commitment. In contrast to a vague sort of liberalism opposed to prejudices and promoting openness of mind." You may ask why I chose to share two stories from the Second World War in a sermon about radical hospitality. Hospitality, after all, is making sure the coffee is fresh at social hour and sending folks home with a welcome packet, maybe a pin if you're from out of state. Absolutely. Absolutely, that's what hospitality is. But radical hospitality is so much more. Radical hospitality is recognizing the core humanity and worth of every single person we meet, no exception. It is the refusal to participate in the dehumanization of anyone. And it requires that we stand together against the tide of hatred, regardless of where that may be. It takes bravery. It takes guts and faith and fortitude. We know the world failed in the case of the Nazi movement. We failed our obligation to humanity, to one another. We must not fail again. And honestly, there are times I get a little nervous. In the 30s, we finally responded to the fact that Jewish lives mattered. Today, radical hospitality calls us to respond more diligently than ever before. Black lives matter. Muslim lives matter. Poor lives matter. Transgender lives matter. James Luther Adams speaks to us through the ages. We must do more than oppose and promote. We must commit, and I believe we must refuse. The power of refusal is not the denial of love or of compassion. It is not turning away from the call we must heed to build the beloved community for all people. It is indeed the refusal not to remain inactive in the face of a world that at times would invite us to become more and more insular. The power of refusal is for each one of us the invitation, as Ruben Alves stated in our opening reading, to plant dates even though we who plant them will never eat them. We must live by the love of what we will never, ever see. Perhaps one of the greatest challenges of our faith is this. How do we, in the face of brokenness, in the face of continued inequity, and in spite of the fact that we live in a world where differences are too often deadly, where mistrust and ignorance can lead too often to the smoking barrel of a gun, literally, where we see the growing chasm between those who have and those whose lives are nothing but bitterness and hopelessness, how do we use our power of refusal, our explicit commitment to rise up as the radically hospitable, radically loving, and radically compassionate people that the world needs us to be? Anne Frank, 15 years old, witness to some of the darkest moments in our history, said this: "In spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart. I simply cannot build up my hopes on a foundation consisting of confusion, misery, and death. In the meantime, I must uphold my ideals, for perhaps the time will come when I shall be able to carry them out." We arrive at this moment in our history standing on the shoulders of countless brave men and women whose sacrifice and voices we can thank for this, our religious heritage. I believe we would do well to reflect on those who have risked and indeed lost their lives for this faith, for those who have made explicit commitments, for those who exercised their power of refusal. I reflect on the lives of the Auschwitz survivors, refusing to live lives dictated by the hatred and terror they experienced. I reflect on the life and words of Anne Frank, on the writings of James Luther Adams. I reflect on the lives and callings of James Reeb and Viola Liuzzo, both Unitarians, killed in Selma, Alabama in 1965. If I had dinner with all of them, I would have some questions. Have we done enough? Have we committed to one another deeply enough? Have we refused to give in to the power of hatred and violence enough? Have we created bonds, one with another, strong enough to allow us to get down to the business of transforming this world? What is required of us if we are to be those people who bend the arc of the moral universe a little more every day, not only towards justice, but towards opening ourselves to hospitality beyond what we have practiced in the past? The challenge we face is believing this faith has the potential to change the world and walk out into that world, giving ourselves over to encounters with the poor, the hungry, the broken, the greedy, and yes, sometimes the violent, with the understanding that we will be transformed. The challenge we face is giving ourselves fully to that deep work that emboldens each of us to offer radical hospitality to everyone. We are congregations filled with miraculous people and all of their pneumasis. People whose minds are capable of visioning the beloved community, whose hospitality is so radical that there is no longer an us and a them, only us. People whose hands are eager to build a more just and equitable world. People whose hearts are ready to love the cursing, spitting street sweepers, the rose growers, the moonshiners, and certainly anyone who feels home enough on a silent Sunday morning to say, hot damn amen. May this be so.